You can donate to KBOO 2 days early.
There you go.
Stay tuned, because we are your community connection and we care about you because you are our boo.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KBOO. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kboo.org or send to KBOO Development Tire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is KBOO important? More information on the development director position is available at kboo.fm/development-hire-2018.
KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years. Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten Free Gem, We Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give or call 503-231-8032. Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO here in Portland, where the time is 9:02, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Before we get into that, I need to let you know that KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. That's pugspdx.com. Well, the Old Mole Variety Hour is coming up right now. The mole is the beast that works underground to root down the mountains built by the system called capitalism. We expose the root of that system and we ally ourselves with the peoples and movements that work for a better world. I'm Clayton Morgridge, along with our engineer, Patricia Kullberg, bringing you interviews, commentary on a Green New Deal for a program that claims to be adequate to the enormous challenge to the survival of life on this planet posed by the climate change that human civilization, over the past 200 years or so, has brought down upon us. The Movie Moles will be speaking to us from 2016 when they reviewed Carol. They will help you decide whether to go see that film about forbidden love in the 1950s that will be shown at the Hollywood Theater on Wednesday, December 12th. And we'll conclude today's show with a discussion from our Left and the Law team about asylum seekers and refugees at the southern border. The Old Mole Variety Hour is podcast every week, so look for us wherever you get your podcasts, or you can hear this show in a day or two on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. You can also find and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Well, first up on today's show, Bill Resnick is going to be talking with Jeremy Brecker about the proposal made by newly elected Congressperson Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for a Green New Deal that would really be adequate to the enormous challenge posed by climate change. Bill.
Hi, Jeremy Brecker. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi. Good to be with you again.
Jeremy Brecker founded, with others, the Labor Network for Sustainability. He's an activist, a writer, makes documentary films, too, written over 10 really valuable books. His early book, Strike, was described as the single most important book about the history of the American labor movement published in our time. It sure was important for me. His books on the environment and climate change include Save the Humans, Common Preservation in Action, and also a book, Climate Insurgency. In 2009, he wrote a piece, Green Jobs and a Global Green New Deal. This year, almost 10 years later, the Green New Deal reached the U.S. Congress when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, now known as AOC, not all of us get known by our capital letters, and 17 other Democratic members of the new Democratic-controlled House proposed, and I quote, the establishment of a select committee for a Green New Deal. Jeremy Brecker and I will be talking about the Green New Deal and whether any Green New Deal legislation and appropriations could get through the current Congress, and I think something meaningful can happen. Some parts even have a chance of implementation at some point, and maybe in some cities. But first, Jeremy Brecker, were you surprised by the surge of interest in a Green New Deal, and how does AOC's proposal and others by this rising sort of radical wing in the Democratic Party, how does it compare to your vision of the Green New Deal?
Am I surprised? I suppose when something suddenly emerges that no one's been talking about in the public arena, hardly even thought of in the political arena, and barely mentioned in the media arena, and then all of a sudden it's out there and it's being talked about and reported on and debated. Of course, you have to be a little surprised. But there's another way in which, to me, it's really something that I've just been waiting for. One can never know the future, certainly, but I've been almost certain that this was going to happen, that it's dictated by the historical situation we're in and the desperate need to address the problem of climate change and the need to do that in a way that recognizes the problems and needs of working people and protects those who might be accidentally hurt by the side effects of climate protection. We need to have a program that will address climate change in its full emergency threat character and at the same time addresses the social consequences and also the social consequences of the era of growing inequality that we live in that has had such a devastating effect on working people in the United States and indeed worldwide. And the conjunction of those forces had meant that something like a Green New Deal to deal with the climate emergency in a socially positive way seemed to me was bound to happen. And I've been waiting for it for at least 10 years, if not longer, and I'm very, very happy that it's here.
It is really amazing. I just read the legislation last night. It makes good reading. It's, though, very complicated. It's not clear which direction it will go in, particularly when it reaches the Congress and the Senate and the Trumpies, if there's going to be log rolling that could, in fact, have a negative effect, is my sense. It's something that we have to think about because, for example, it talks about one of the major goals being the development and construction of a new, smart national grid. Well, that's exactly what the investor-owned utilities need if they want to maintain control of everything. What they're afraid of is local and regional energy supplies that would be stable, where there's storage, it's resilient, stuff you've written about. It's a great document, actually. It touches all the bases. Tell us what you think about a lot of the specifics in there. It seems to me in some ways it's not clear what direction this could move in.
Well, a couple of things regarding that. Let me start by responding to the specific question you raised about the tension between more centralized and more decentralized ways of addressing climate issues and making the transition to 100% climate-safe energy, which is at the core of what we need to do. And my personal take on it is this is not really a choice. In World War II, when the American industry mobilized to combat the Nazis and provide the planes and tanks that were needed to do that, we had General Motors and the largest corporate actually being forced by the government to do the things that were needed in terms of war production, and forced, believe it or not, to shut down the production of civilian cars in order to be able to devote those resources, human and material, to the necessities of wartime mobilization. And at the same time, you had tiny, tiny enterprises, small backyard machine shops and subcontractors and just small-scale producers who also expanded enormously to help meet the demand for war materials. And I think we're in a similar situation here. We don't really have the opportunity to say we like one approach to protecting the climate better than another one, and so we're only going to do that one. We're basically in a situation like wartime mobilization where we have to do everything. So I personally think that we have to have decentralized energy systems and the ways that if people want to put solar collectors on their roofs as hobbyists, and if people in neighborhoods want to create community solar neighborhood-based small-scale facilities, that we have to have the kind of funding and technical support that allows them to do that. But I think we also are going to have utility
installations.
And let me just say one more thing about the grid, which is a national grid can be a centralizing force, as you say, but it also can be the vehicle that makes very decentralized local energy production be viable, because it allows energy to move around from one place to another. So if you put on your rooftop solar and the sun goes out, it rains for a month, you can compensate for that with energy from other places and other technologies. So the grid in itself is not necessarily the enemy of a decentralized system.
No, in fact, it's necessary to some extent. And these grids, though, could be regional, and there would be storage in every region. So, in fact, if a huge storm knocks down these huge pylons on some mountain, or in California, when you get wildfires that are so hot that they melt the wires and destroy everything, that you still have power in a city, at least for the hospitals and to keep medicines refrigerated and food refrigerated, to do the basics.
This is really just a footnote to the need for an emergency mobilization. The greatest significance of the proposal for a select committee for a Green New Deal. After all, these are things that have not even really been discussed in the public arena. The details, the devil is always in the details and everything to do with energy and climate policy, but the plan for a select committee that will go in depth to develop a plan, but at the same time that's mandated by this legislation to come up with a plan that is actually on the scale and scope of what we need to protect ourselves from climate devastation, I think it is a huge step forward.
Yeah, it is, although I think we should really be thinking about that in the ways we support it. That is, a left supports it, and within this select committee, a left will at least be able to be heard. and be on TV and promote its ideas. It seems to me this is a wonderful possibility. There's a lot to be said for community energy, not that it's going to create 80% or even 50% or maybe even 30% of the meeting power needs, but it can create a culture of conservation and a very different sort of way of looking at public goods in any community. I see it as a way of politicizing a local economy, and after all, it has a lot of local power and people are really interested in it, and especially local jobs, of course, and local vitality. It seems to me that's one of the arguments for not allowing the big utilities and the big construction companies to take over all of it and all of the money, which is what they would like to do. They're already angling for that. I think that's the argument, at least, for really emphasizing the local, Jeremy. How do you respond to that?
I agree completely with as much possible local and decentralized energy production as we can do. We need to have that, but we need to have the smaller scale energy provision and community-based, and as much as possible, as much to the extent that that can meet the needs, it should be emphasized. And I think you would find most of the people who are supporting this bill in agreement with that.
Yeah, I think so too.
This bill is very much oriented toward a social justice approach to climate protection, and that involves local democratization and expansion of local control of financing. It's just we shouldn't be shooting down the larger scale provision, because we desperately need that as well. In terms of an overall World War II style mobilization of all the resources of our society in order to make the transformation
right.
We need.
Just a footnote, when I talk about local scale, I'm talking about Texas and California, which is vast regions that would cooperate together. We don't have to do it from all big solar plantations don't have to be in New Mexico or Arizona, and they can be much closer to the point of use, and they can be then governed in the point of use, and cities would have much more of a role. Anyway, we completely agree. These are all details. This is KABU Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Jeremy Brecker. For at least 10 years, he's been writing on and speaking about the Green New Deal as the only means of preserving human life and what we call civilization, not very civilized, indeed quite warlike, it seems to me, nowadays. Jeremy is talking about the Green New Deal. It's really the only option we have for saving that civilization as global heating threatens cataclysm. Jeremy, if it got to Congress, what do you see as going on? There's going to be a huge amount of log rolling. My sense is in the early years, even if it ever got there, and we don't have too much time left, that compromises would be made that would favor corporate power in one way or another. How to work now to make sure that at least the models of what really would work, how do you see that occurring?
Well, I think there are a couple of very important things about the people who have been promoting the Green New Deal and the Select Committee for a Green New Deal. One is that they have been very open to mass direct participation in the campaign. Actually, the way this got started was a youth climate group called the Sunrise Movement occupied Nancy Pelosi's office, demanding that the Democrats develop a policy that rapidly responding to the problems of climate change. And Representative Ocasio-Cortez came into the meeting with her proposed legislation. And in general, she and her allies have been extremely open to the youth climate movement being directly involved right there in the congressional offices promoting what's needed. So there isn't that wall between let the politicians do their thing on the inside and the people are locked out on the outside. They definitely see it as someone put it, their role is to bring the movement into Congress. And the other thing that I think is an important factor here is, again, the same forces have been very involved in a parallel campaign to demand that Democratic politicians, especially people in Congress, refuse to take money from the fossil fuel interests. and they actually passed a resolution through the Democratic National Committee a few months ago banning the acceptance of fossil fuel contributions by Democratic candidates. And then there was a big counter push, which I regret to say was supported by parts of organized labor, to say this was an insult to workers in the fossil fuel industry, and they should, of course, accept contributions from the fossil fuel interests, and the Democratic National Committee reversed its position. But more than 1,000 Democratic candidates in the last midterm elections at various levels took the pledge not to accept fossil fuel contributions. And I think making a issue within the Democratic Party of are we going to allow ourselves to be dominated by these enemies of humanity or not, think of it as a little like the politicians and the religious organizations that accepted monies from slaveholders before the Civil War, and the abolitionists made a huge moral issue about should, for example, religious organizations be accepting funding from slaveholders. And that was one of the ways that they drew the issue of are you for slavery or are you against it? And this is part of our drawing the issue today about are you against climate change or, in fact, in practice, are you for it? And it's a way of identifying and isolating the friends of climate change.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Jeremy Bricker, who's written a lot of books on social movements and struggle and the way the unexpected often happens, great upsurges that we never expected. Perhaps we're now in a world where those upsurges have become almost inevitable. We have to deal with climate change. Jeremy, one final thing. In your book, Strike, that was what I recall, at least, in the book Strike. And you have a new edition out, actually.
Well, I'm happy to say there is a new updated edition of Strike with a new section called Mini Revolts of the 21st Century. And it deals with things like Battle of Seattle against the World Trade Organization and the Occupy Wall Street movement, and most recently the teachers' movements in Chicago and elsewhere for the protection and expansion of public education. And we've seen these after a long period in which it seemed as which in which the strike was almost just history. We've seen very extensive return to the use of the strike, but often in very new and innovative ways. We've seen things like the Fight for 15 for low-wage workers, and we've seen things like the strikes by teachers on huge state-by-state basis in West Virginia and other states with extreme attacks on public education and the well-being of teachers, where there's been an amazing fight back using strikes allied with broad community organization to restore and protect and expand public education.
Jeremy, you may have to write another edition of Strike, because I think we may be in this period of upsurge, which is absolutely necessary, and people are beginning to understand that it's going to be as powerful as anyone in the past, it seems to me, because it's survival of all of us is at stake in some way, and I think people are beginning to understand that. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Great. Thanks for listening.
On the century, and we are armed to the teeth. We're all working together now to make our lives merciful.
And that's Annie DeFranco, Armed to the Teeth, following Bill Resnick's interview with Jeremy Brecker about the proposal for a Green New Deal. Now, I have some thoughts about how this proposal could both save and transform our lives for the better. The report of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, released last month, seems to have tasked the governments of the world and more broadly the human species with an impossible task: to reduce and eliminate the use of fossil fuels by the end of the next decade. Doing so could prevent the most serious climate catastrophes that will otherwise occur within the lifetimes of most of the world's population. We have the knowledge and tools we need to make the changes in the production and use of energy that would be necessary to avoid the destruction from floods, fires, heat waves, droughts, rising sea levels, and crop failures. What has been lacking is a concrete, actionable proposal put before the U.S. Congress that is equal to the task. As we heard in Bill Resnick's conversation with Jeremy Brecker, there is now such a proposal before Congress. But first, let's consider how enormous the task before us is. Every item produced, transported, and used or consumed by the Earth's 7 billion people involves the use of energy at every stage, from the mining, growing, and transporting of raw materials, the manufacturing process, the transportation of the products, to the use of products, especially those that use power like stoves, computers, cars, and jet planes, including fighter jets and bombers. How could all this energy be either eliminated or else produced without burning carbon? If we fail, if we go on adding CO2 to the atmosphere, thereby increasing the temperatures of the ocean, the air, and the earth, and ramping up a cascade of snowballing effects, leading ultimately to the end of life as we know it, or indeed of all life, then what kind of crime would we be guilty of? Of course, it is not really we, all of humanity, that is engaged in committing the crime of destroying the thin layer of water, soil, and air on which life depends, but rather the masters of capital, whose profits and power depend on the continuing expropriation and burning of buried carbon to fuel their industries. Any direct attack on their access to oil, coal, and natural gas is an attack on the foundations of their lifeblood, the flow of profits, and the ever-expanding growth of capital. The flow of capital from profits to investment to production to sale, and thus to more profits that must in turn be invested, this flow underlies and saturates life in capitalist society, which is why, as it has been written, it is easier to imagine the end of the world than to imagine the end of capitalism. But if we see that it is capitalism that will lead to the end of the world, we had better learn to imagine and to implement the end of capitalism. Here's where the proposal for a select committee for a Green New Deal comes in. The select committee, according to the proposal, shall have authority to develop a detailed national industrial economic mobilization plan for the transition of the United States economy to become carbon neutral and to significantly draw down and capture greenhouse gases from the atmosphere and oceans, and to promote economic and environmental justice and equality, end of quote. Like the original New Deal, this calls for more than a legislative proposal or even a package of bills. It has to be, quoting from Mike Carr, a fundamental shift in approach that is relentless and comprehensive, unquote. Such a fundamental shift is obvious in the list of goals for the Select Committee, all to be achieved in the next 10 years. Here's what they are. First, 100% national power generation from renewable sources. Secondly, building a national energy-efficient smart grid, though possibly in a more localized form, as Bill Resnick and Jeremy Brecker discussed earlier. Third, upgrading every residential and industrial building for state-of-the-art energy efficiency, comfort, and safety. 4, decarbonizing the manufacturing, agricultural, and other industries. 5, decarbonizing, repairing, and improving transportation and other infrastructure. 6, funding massive investment in the drawdown and capture of greenhouse gases. And finally, 7, making green technology, industry, expertise, products, and services a major export of the United States, with the aim of becoming the undisputed international leader in helping other countries transition to completely carbon-neutral economies and bringing about a global Green New Deal. The proposal for a Green New Deal adds that a national industrial economic mobilization of this scope and scale is a historic opportunity to virtually eliminate poverty in the United States and to make prosperity, wealth, and economic security available to everyone participating in the transformation, unquote. Accordingly, it calls for guaranteed employment for everyone who wants to work, and obviously the plan calls for a lot of work, for a national universal health plan and some form of guaranteed income. The Green New Deal does not rely on the private sector to pull all of this off. Rather, quoting from the proposal, the majority of financing of the plan shall be accomplished by the federal government using a combination of the Federal Reserve, a new public bank or system of regional and specialized public banks, and public venture funds, in order to ensure that interest and other investment returns generated from public investments made in connection with this plan will be returned to the Treasury, reduce taxpayer burden, and allow for more investment, unquote. Well, it is unlikely that the Ocasio-Cortez proposal for a select committee will be agreed to by the Democratic leadership with their ties to big energy companies. And even if it were, its proposals could not survive the Republican Senate or the current president. But the proposal is something that can and must be at the center of a political movement that is fully and openly aware that the claims of the very rich to own and control the productive wealth of our nation are bogus. That wealth must now be devoted not to the profits of a few, but to the survival and the flourishing of the many, and not only the many humans, but of our living planet and all its creatures. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And look at where the profits are. That's how you'll find the source of the big lie that you and I both know so well. In the time it takes this cultural death.
And that's a little bit more from Annie DeFranco's song Armed to the Teeth, which metaphorically is maybe what we need to be to challenge the rule of capital and save ourselves and life on this planet. Well, this is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO, your community-owned and operated radio station, broadcasting to the area in and around Portland and to the world via KBOO.fm. Well, on Wednesday, December 12th, the Hollywood Theater will screen Todd Haynes' 2015 film Carol in 35mm. Presented for the holiday season as part of the Hollywood Theater's once-monthly Queer Commons Film Festival, Carol stars Kate Blanchett and Rooney Mara and tells the story of a forbidden love affair further troubled by age and class differences in 1950s New York. Movie Mole's Fran Michel and Denise Morris reviewed Carol in January of 2016.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel with Denise Morris to discuss Carol. Carol is the latest feature from director Todd Haynes, perhaps best known for the Douglas Sirk homage, Far From Heaven. It's based on the 1952 novel originally titled The Price of Salt, written by Patricia Highsmith, who also wrote Strangers on a Train, The Talented Mr. Ripley, and other books made into films, though The Price of Salt was originally published under a different name. like Highsmith's Ripley novels, The Price of Salt was unusual for its day in allowing the protagonists to escape the usual fate of literary characters who violate the conventions and rules of bourgeois life. In Carol, unlike the film versions of the crime novels, the ending has not been changed. The screenplay is by Phyllis Nagy, who knew Highsmith and spent years bringing Carol to the screen. The film stars Cate Blanchett in the title role and Rooney Mara as Therese. The two women meet when young Therese is working the Christmas rush in the toy section of a department store, and the wealthy older Carol comes in to buy a gift for her daughter. This film has gotten almost universal praise from critics and viewers, and I think we'd both agree it's worth seeing, though it might work better if you've not read the book. So let's talk about what's great and what's not so great.
Well, Fran, I like to think of this film as my guilty pleasure. It's a beautiful film. It really stays true to a particular style Hollywood film, as Todd Haynes did, as you mentioned, with Far From Heaven. This film has been talked about to death. I spent hours reading reviews, so I actually kind of enjoyed it. Well, of course, one of the most compelling aspects of the film is the way that it looks and the use of gesture and composition and glances to kind of tell a story that cannot be told in a particular way under the circumstances that these women are living in, particularly under the circumstances that Carol lives in, because she's upper class and she is seen as being far more constrained by the moral imperative than Therese is, who is a little bit more of a bohemian girl coming of age in a completely different generational environment. So the film, I think, in its style, does something that films did in that period of time following the House Un-American, whatever that was.
HUAC, House Un-American Activities Committee. The McCarthy era, which is mentioned briefly. There's one of the characters, one of Therese's friends, one of the young artists, just getting started in life, kind of artist types, mentions, I'm going to report you to HUAC. It sort of indexed that this is a period of time when people are under surveillance. And certainly Carol is concerned about the way that Harge's family perceives her because it has an impact on custody questions in their divorce. But we get the sense that Therese's friends, the younger, more artsy bohemian crowd, which has less to lose, is able to joke about these things already in 52.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think that in that period of time, in the real period of time following the 1947 Hollywood blacklist, films took all sorts of routes to talk about things that couldn't be talked about explicitly. So I might argue that I think as Todd Haynes came into the picture on this film as a director, his love of that period and the stylings merged it with that sensibility that we're going to tell this story in a way that we might have had to tell it in that period of time. Now, I'm only guessing, and as I said, it's a guilty pleasure. So I did really appreciate the film, and I appreciated its approach and its sense of visual composition and artistry and glamour, frankly. Now, and for some, it was just too pretty and too glamorous.
Yeah, some critics have suggested it's art directed to within an inch of its life. That, you know, Carol's hair matches her coat, matches. It's very beautiful film.
Yeah.
And as people have noted, it's sort of visual style inspired by the photography of Saul Leiter, who was working in that era. And that sort of emphasis on the visual is one of the things that's changed from the book also, that Therese in the book is a theater designer. In the film, she's a photographer, which makes sense, right? We get a much more sort of direct emphasis on her visual gaze rather than her thoughts, which is the book is sort of focalized through Therese's perspective on things. So we get that sense of the visual and sort of the excuse for all those beautiful compositions and colors and that kind of muted tones. And everything is shot through the rain. And it rains a lot in this movie.
It really does. And it's, you know, it's Christmas. Well, I guess they do get a little snow here and there.
But
I think it's the next Hollywood holiday classic.
Yes, the holiday classic of Carol. But also the visuals, as we were talking earlier, sort of fit with the question of things being conveyed through glances, right? The conventions of their eyes meet and something happens. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the sort of element of cruising, basically, that you can tell by looking at somebody and you can sort of maneuver things so that you just know about them.
You know, that's interesting because in Far From Heaven, Frank, who is married to Kathy in that film, does go cruising. That's a different avenue for the male homosexual in the 50s. But both Carol and Frank are trapped in these marriages. Marriage is a trap, by the way, in these films.
Yes.
If anyone's curious about how marriage is functioning, it's repressive. It's a repressive trap.
It's a repressive trap. No question about that.
Right. There is a little bit of cruising in this. I mean, it's playful. I would also argue that that's part of what I love about this film is that I think that there's humor there. There's a lot of playfulness there. There's two characters who arguably have no idea what they're doing at the time, but know what they want and what they don't want, or maybe more what they don't want and are about to discover what they do want in a way that is more fulfilling than the sort of secret sliding in the shadows that must go on at times.
Yeah.
Or more like Far From Heaven, which seems to convey something more about the darkness, the shadowy world of gay life.
Right.
Whereas Carol is a little bit more glamorous.
A little more glamorous.
But she's got a house in New Jersey, so.
Yeah. Yes, Carol has a house in New Jersey. But yeah, there's an early moment when they go, I don't know, they go into a coffee shop or something, and there's two women standing over by the corner, and there is a series of glances, and it's like, huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're just a little bit more butch looking than the main characters in the film, who are conventionally feminine and beautiful and so
on. Right, but it does say something about, again, that generational and class dynamic, because Carol's world is portrayed as constrictive because it has to do with how upstanding you are and how capable you are of holding up your end of the moral code in a marriage and as an upstanding citizen. In the city, you might just happen to see two out women who are together, and even in 1952. So not as to say that gay people didn't exist or that somehow there's so much difference between now and then, even though obviously there has been progress made.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the critiques that some critics have had of the film is this idea that we're invited to sort of feel smug about how far we've come since 1952, that, like, yeah, you want to leave your husband for another woman? Fine, just leave him. No big deal, right? There's not a story there in the same way that there was in 1952. Although, depending on where, I mean, in New York, there would not be a story there. If you lived in Virginia, there might be a story there.
Right, and as recently as in my own life, in the 80s, in the mid to late 80s, women leaving their husband as they came out was a big deal. So we're not so far removed, and it still happens.
Yeah, so we shouldn't be feeling quite so smug about
that. Yeah, I don't feel smug.
I don't feel smug.
There's lots and lots to talk about, particularly because Highsmith was so prolific, and she wrote crime novels. She wrote Price of Salt. I'm not sure if you said this in your intro, but she wrote that book under a pen name, Claire Morgan, and she seemed to have had somewhat, or probably has been studied as someone having a queer vision of her own.
Yeah. She talked about people having written to her about the book and saying, you know, once her name was associated with it and they knew that she had written it, and saying, oh, I identified so much, and, you know, you told my story, this is so wonderful, so that people really appreciated it because it was one of a very small number of books in which the queer characters did not end up having to go crazy, turn straight, die tragically. You know, I mean, nobody's life was really ruined. Right. Spoiler, things turn out okay for everybody.
But there's a tremendous amount of heartbreak. And one thing that Todd Haynes points out, and I think is probably a common thought about Highsmith's work, is as a person who explored the criminal mind in that book, is she exploring the amorous mind? And in what way do those two things overlap?
Yeah.
In that the criminal mind always has to know where they stand with the people around them. There's something very similar there.
Yeah. The anxiety of, does this person who I love me back? Are they going to continue loving me? Are they, like, what did she mean by that? Mm-hmm. How come our date got broken? You know, what's going on? That sense of wanting to understand what's going on, not always being able to have the complete information one would like, but having it be really, really important to one's happiness, success, continued freedom, and right. so on.
Actually, Kate Blanchett spoke really, I think, eloquently and in a way that appealed to me as someone who has acting experience and loved that process of digging, talked about the austerity and the idea that you didn't talk about your feelings. So there's lots to dig around in the film. I think I would encourage people to not underestimate the film's content and depth, but also there are some things to critique, including race questions.
It is a white Christmas.
It's a very white Christmas.
Yeah. But it's beautiful and worth seeing, and I think I might actually go see it again at the Hollywood. Right. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel and Denise Morris discussing Carol.
Okay, and so now we're to close out today's show. We have our Left and the Law team, Jan Hocken and Mike Snediger, to discuss the current situation of asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border and the Trump administration's ongoing violation of international law on the treatment of refugees, including asylum seekers. Here are Jan and Mike.
On November 9th, Trump signed a proclamation declaring that people who cross the border between official U.S. ports of entry would be ineligible for asylum. The president cited a threat to national security prompted by the groups of migrants headed toward the U.S. Well, 10 days later, a federal judge in California temporarily blocked the Trump administration from refusing asylum to migrants who cross the U.S. southern border illegally. Well, Mike, can you explain the basis of this federal judge's decision and his interpretation of Trump's legal reasoning? Then we'll go into some of what's at stake around asylum politics.
The judge's decision was based on the laws regarding asylum. Unlike the Muslim ban, which was largely a matter of executive discretion, and the courts reached its decisions there by looking at Trump's intent, like reading his tweets. Here, there's a very explicit statute that says that you can apply for asylum, quote, whether or not you entered at a designated point of arrival. That's part of the law that arose in the late 70s when the concept of human rights first spread around the world. And it was a bipartisan product, that law. At that time, Republicans mostly thought about Russians and people in Eastern Europe laboring under oppression. But the fact is, everyone voted for it. It has been the law, and it's quite explicit. It forbids Trump from doing what he did. What he is doing overall, I think he's mounting a comprehensive war on the whole concept of asylum by choking off any sort of entry at entry rates, lying and deceiving people who actually do manage to get through, or denying them their right to apply, and then trying to ban anybody who comes around those designated ports and comes through by some other means, even though the statute specifically says they can apply for asylum.
So as the brief notes, that as part of that commitment, Congress has clearly commanded in the INA that any alien who arrives in the United States, irrespective of that alien status, may apply for asylum, whether or not at a designated port of entry. So the administration's claim that those who enter at outside of the official ports of entry will can either be detained or deported violates that aspect of our own law.
Yeah, we don't need to look to international treaties or anything other than federal codes.
So what this was a pretty prompt ruling as legal processes go. It's on the one hand, it's clear that Trump is playing to his basic constituency and building fear of outsiders, people at the border, casting them as threatening. This is a very old song, and and this is like the 100th verse of the same song. How should we be responding to it on the left? There are these cases, and of course those are important to support. What do you think our position should be on this from a left perspective?
Well, it should be a rejection of every part of his war on asylum. That works from law, and there's some really brilliant lawyers now and lots of people supporting them who moved very quickly and had a comprehensive, well-written attack supported by lots of community groups ready within days of this order. And the other aspects, the separation of families, is also being litigated. The blockage of people at ports of arrival, the lying to people at ports of arrival. There are good lawsuits against all this. They should be pursued, because just as 10 years from now, when our progressive measures are going to be thwarted by these Trump judges who are now being appointed, right now there are judges who are quite willing to stand up if they're given a good legal basis for so doing. But of course, beyond the legal effort, which is ripe and is happening and should be supported, there's the general need to point out the human faces that are actually being labeled as monstrous. It's beyond being a joke, because so many of these people come from the Northern Triangle of countries of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, fleeing from conditions that we, during the Obama years, for example, made far worse for the people there by supporting coups of democratically elected people with progressive policies.
We're deeply implicated in their suffering and the conditions from which they're
Absolutely.
Fleeing.
Absolutely. And then the people who are coming here as these plaintiffs, these are women with children, people who are really plucky, people who have nothing to lose, and therefore they take on the long trip across hostile territory in Mexico to get here. It's just to tell the stories, to keep a focus on who these people really are, is essential backup supporting of litigation.
One aspect of the discourse of the migrants headed toward the border and coming together in groups for protection, which I think is different from how Trump portrays them, as traveling in groups of as gangs rather than people seeking security in one another. So that sometimes there is this acknowledgement that there are people fleeing extreme violence and threats of violence, but also people seeking a better life. And asylum criteria are very strict. And in fact, that's another way the Trump administration is trying to dismantle asylum. Asylum policy is by narrowing the ground so women escaping domestic violence and many other forms of interpersonal violence are excluded. But I think it is important to acknowledge that there are many reasons that people seek a better life, and that the asylum, the criteria for asylum, often even under previous administrations that were more open, can be quite strict.
Well, it's always going to be a continuum, Jan. There's going to be people who, on the one hand, will be dismembered quickly if they are returned to their country. There are other people who grew up in an environment where they had no running water, where they had miserable living conditions, and they seek a better life. Those latter people do not qualify for asylum. So where's the line? You know, there will always be litigation around that line. You know, Jeff Sessions made a big move of the line toward restriction by eliminating domestic violence as one of the reasons, or the one of the threats that allows you to qualify for asylum. But there will always be disputes over that margin where people are indeed threatened if they don't cooperate with gangs who control all the commerce in many neighborhoods of every city in Honduras. And if you don't if you run a grocery store and don't pay your monthly allotment, or if somebody you know was hurt very badly, or if you were threatened, at what point does it become severe enough or scary enough for you to be granted asylum?
And it is for many people who flee under those conditions, it is difficult, if not impossible, to bring the required evidence or paperwork to support their claims. So, you know, asylum cases are difficult to evaluate, and you have to produce a story that moves the gatekeepers at the borders who assess these cases. So it is itself a way of sorting people into more or less compelling cases.
Yeah, you have to establish a credible fear. What does that mean? Well, it can mean written statements or testimony from people who will support your version. How much support do you need? Of course, that, like any trial in the U.S., varies according to who's hearing the case, what evidence he or she is going to find persuasive, how much he or she will need in order to be moved.
Shouldn't we then be arguing for open borders and supporting that people are here for a reason? People generally do not leave their homes and travel thousands of miles under difficult conditions unless they have a pretty good reason. And we should welcome them and help them find their way.
That is the only answer, ultimately. I mean, capital is allowed to move freely. Why shouldn't people?
If you have enough money, you can travel anywhere in the world other than perhaps some remote island somewhere where it's dangerous. But capital is very mobile, and people with money can go pretty much anywhere across borders.
But the striking thing right now is that under our present laws, designed and restrictive as they are, and Trump is blatantly violating them, and he's being held to account in lawsuits brought by really courageous and smart people, and their judges are striking him down, and they need to push, they will push, we need to support these legal efforts every way we can, and we need to keep shining a light on who these people really are and what they've been through to counter the notion that they're all a lot of 18th Street gang thugs milling around hoping to come over here and rape and rob and run amok.
And that should mean that everyone who makes it to the border must meet some extreme standard of virtue, because people who've suffered often act out in various ways, especially kids. And so if I think there's often pressure on groups in these situations to meet an extreme standard of virtue, even though they have been through so much. And so I think that is important to acknowledge as well.
Sure. Well, emblematic people like plaintiffs in these lawsuits look pretty good. I mean, the woman whose 4-year-old was snatched from her after having walked from Honduras in the lawsuit brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights against Family
Separation. She's a model plaintiff.
She's a model plaintiff. There's no shortage of model plaintiffs. But you're right. I mean, the focus is on what has been done to you and what may well happen if you are returned, not how virtuous you are or how pure your heart may be.
Okay, so this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the federal judge in California who temporarily blocked the Trump administration's latest vicious attack on migrants and asylum seekers. So we'll keep shining a light on these cases.
And, we will.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Jan and Mike, the Left and the Law team. And thanks for that great discussion about border politics. And thanks also to Denise Morris for supplying the Movie Moles review from 2016 of Carol. And thanks to Bill Resnick and Jeremy Brecker for their discussion of the proposal for a Green New Deal. And thanks, as always, to Patricia Kullberg for engineering this show. I'm Clayton Margaridge. Tune in again next Monday morning for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Moles Underground Perspective. Look for our podcasts wherever podcasts are available, or listen to or download our shows or their separate pieces from our webpage in the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and the time now is just a minute before 10 o'clock. Coming up on the Boo at 11 o'clock, Making Contact looks at efforts to reform local criminal justice systems in an effort to send fewer people to jail. And at 11:30, Madness Radio explores voices and visions from outside mental health. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Coming up next on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey from Columbia Riverkeeper about the dangers of the proposed world's largest methanol refinery. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Columbia Land Trust, conserving and connecting people with the nature of the Northwest. More information, including tours, events, and volunteer opportunities online at columbialandtrust.org. Now, stay tuned for Locus Focus.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO, in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Clinton Street Resistance Series at the Clinton Street Theatre in Portland. Monday, December the 3rd, at 7 p.m. will be Dune, playing as a benefit for Impact Northwest. Dune is a 1984 American epic science fiction film written and directed by David Lynch, and is the controversial adaptation of Frank Herbert's cult science fiction novel. Again, that's Dune, playing Monday, December the 3rd at Clinton Street Theatre, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm.